All right, guys, let's go. TJ, at it.
TJ.
All right, man, we're going to jump into 8 and 9 here. It's been my experience that guys that are in situations like yours or anybody just kind of coming off the street to go into meetings, like, there oftentimes there's not a lot of willingness and not a lot of honesty going on with some people, but they are more than ready to make amends. It's weird. It's like they want that to be step one because of all the guilt and shame of the things that have happened out there. It's like, I've got to go fix it because I'm sitting here thinking about what I've done, and I know those people are thinking about me, and I'm so important that they need me to come into their lives and fix their situation so they can move on, you know. But it's all a self-serving act. And so all this stuff, there's a reason they're in order, and there's a reason that they fall exactly the way they do. We don't have what it takes to do step 9, 8, and 9 in the beginning until we've done the rest of it. And I would argue that we never have what it takes without God's power. We don't have what it takes to do any of this stuff. And well, Dylan was talking about 6 and 7. I used to believe that there was so little involved in that paragraph that it was because they didn't really know how to expand on it. They really didn't understand what it was. But like he says, the whole book, and I did we went through the process recently. I had a list of grosser handicaps or character defects or sins or whatever you want to call them. And they were exactly the same ones I had a year prior, okay? I had a guy work the steps with me during this time that was, you know, followed my lead, and he has 21 years, and he had a really long list of handicaps. Okay, this guy's been in meetings the whole time and sponsored people and not fallen away, and he's been living this life for a long time, yet he had this long list of handicaps. And Dylan got into it, but the belief is that I don't know anybody who's prayed a 7-step prayer and woken up and had a handicap gone. We need them, because if we don't have them, why do I need God? You know, so I still have them. That's the reason I pray. The same ones that Dylan talked about that I have, this wanting to be something among others and to be seen. Another one is my experience is the experience. So I think I used to struggle with that a lot of times and tell you guys that if you didn't have my experience out there, you didn't need to be here. And that's what sometimes we get into this thing where we talk about romanticizing and our drug along and all the stuff we talked about. It's important to identify. But in places like this, well, this, it probably doesn't apply in a place like this. We got some low bottom folks in here, okay? There's no doubt about it. What happens sometimes you go to a meeting and you hear a guy who's still got his life together and still got some stuff going on and shows up at a meeting and hears people talking about needles and crack houses, and he says, I don't belong here because I haven't done that yet. If drugs were a problem, that would be the situation, but it's not the problem. We're going to move way past that, and now we're up to cleaning up the past where we have these ideas that are issues that we cause other people were drug-related. And oftentimes it was, but really it was just the selfishness and self-centeredness run riot, you know? So we have this list. It says we made it when we took inventory. I've also found that there's also people that make my amends list that I didn't have an inventory, I didn't have a resentment towards. Now, it may have been on a conduct inventory or sex inventory, but there's often people that I can honestly say did nothing wrong to me at all, were wonderful people, and I screwed them over. So they make this list. So we make this list out. There's a million different ways you do it. Some guys will have you write one name on an index card. And like this idea of like, am I willing yet? What is the amends? Is this money related to it? And if I'm willing, I make a check on it. If I'm not, I don't. You know, you can be okay to not do the ones up front, but we have to get involved in the action right away. There's a school of thought of people that say, particularly our sponsor in the tree he's from, you go to the ends of earth and you make all of them and you don't stop until they're done, you know, and you try your very best. And there's other people that say, you know, make the amends that keep you up at night first or whatever. I mean, it goes from sponsor to sponsor. It is a beautiful part. Every time that I make one, I get closer. I just take one step closer to God. Now, that kind of flies in the face of what I've been saying earlier, that you can never be that close to God. But what it is the veil between me and him has dropped a little bit, and I can see a little bit clearer. If you make it a real amends and you walk out of that place where you're at, where it's an office or somebody's house, the air feels better, your feet feel lighter, the stress is less. It's just the way it works. It's a powerful thing, and there's a reason that we're supposed to do it the way we're supposed to do it. So when I got first sober, I was fired up to do this, man. I went out that I made amends that probably shouldn't have been done. It's just because I wanted to have a bunch of them on my list. I wanted to knock them all off. So I went to people and had discussions about stuff, and they're like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, you know. Most people, I've never had a situation where somebody's like, hey, get the fuck out of here. I'm not ready to hear it. Most people are blown away. It's just not a real world thing that you see out in the real world for people to come to you hat in hand and admit their own faults and ask what they can do to make it right. Most people are pretty uncomfortable, and they'll try to stop you, particularly mom. Everybody wants to go. Mom's like, no, stop. You have to kind of power through that and say, no, you've got to let me do this for me, you know. I also had a couple. I went and made amends to a former employer that started, like, giggling when I did it, and he opened his drawer and pulled out, like, a 30-year chip. I had no idea. And he's like, I know what you're doing, and I'm going to let you go all the way through. And he sat there and listened to me, and then, you know, he gave me the idea. So it was a powerful experience. The one way, and I'll let Dylan get into the semantics and some of that stuff and tell his own stories about it, but the real way 8 and 9 come alive in a setting like this for us to talk about is to talk about some of the experiences we had with it. Now, when I first got sober, I owed my dad an amends, and, well, let me take that back. When I first got sober, I was certain that my dad owed me an amends. That's different. Every inventory I ever did, when I started writing, on top of the page, God helped me to be honest, resentment one, dad, resentment two, dad, all the way down. I wanted to get everything out because I wanted to show my first sponsor how terrible he was to me. That's not the place to write inventory from. Remember, we're crossing over the bridge. This is not that person's inventory. This is ours. Where do we show up? But the first time I was sober, I never had someone tell me and explain to me that that's not the way it works. So I built, there's just this theory of like telling yourself a story. Okay, we all have these things where we tell a story about ourselves based on someone else's actions that's oftentimes not real. So when I was growing up, my parents were never married, so I did the every other weekend thing with my dad. But dad's really driven in business, still is. He was never around. So the weekends I would see him, go to his house. Friday night I'd go over there, no dad. I would go to bed, wake up in the morning, no dad. He'd come in late, got up, went back to work again. And he was the type of guy that would show up on Saturday afternoon, take a nap, and then it was like fun time. And he'd buy a four-wheeler, take us to do this. So he bought our love with money and stuff, and we loved it. We took it, you know. We'd go to the movies, whatever, do all this stuff. Saturday morning made me go to church, and this is one of those churches of like where it was all fire and brimstone, like a old country roadside church, sin. And I knew how he was living his life, and I knew he wasn't living what the preacher was saying. But he was raising his hands and all this stuff and cheating on my stuff. It was a nightmare. That's what really happened. It is what it is. But I told myself a story that because of that I wasn't good enough, I was unloved, and my dad didn't even want me. That's the story I told myself. I learned that story was a lie when I was 38 years old. So for all those years, I locked myself in a prison that I had the own key up to. Was if my dad would have been there for me, I wouldn't be in this situation. If my dad never looked at a report card, never came to a game, the same old sad story, had no idea what was going on in my life. And my mom was the opposite, babied me until, well, I'm 41 and still does. So, they built two sides of me. One of them, my mom was, you're the most important, special, handsome, beautiful boy in the whole world. And my dad, the idea I got was, you're worthless. So those two things competed forever. The last time, before I met Tarek, I did steps with a guy named Tim. And he sat down and asked me to consider that my dad had never done anything to me. That everything was a lie. It was a story I told myself. And finally, after relapsing and coming back, and going through the work again, I realized that my dad didn't do anything to me. It was a lie that I told me about what he did. Dylan talked about some of our resentments are fancy to real. That's another word of saying they're bullshit. We made them up. So oftentimes a person looks at us and we think they're looking at me, they're judging me, and they have no idea what's going on. And that's the deal with my dad. He did the very best he could. It wasn't good enough, whatever it is. But he never once told me I wasn't good enough, or wasn't loved and not worthy to be a part of a family or love. Never said that. I said that stuff about me. And so I had to let that go. And what does that mean now? the reason our relationship is in the situation it is because of me, not because of him. So I had to go back and make it right. I actually work with my dad still to this day, which makes it much more difficult. Maybe that's an excuse. But I had to make an amends to him, and this is what the crazy thing that happened. We cried for the first time I ever, hugged, everything was good. Nothing changed in that relationship. He was still an asshole at work. In fact, I've been in a situation where I've worked with him for 15 years with the understanding that this company, when he retires, that he was going to give it to me. 3 weeks ago, he sat me down and said, I sold the business. He didn't sell it to me. So the first thought is, all this time sober and all the spiritual stuff I say and I pray and meditate and smart stuff was, you fucked me. That's what I said, you know. And so it started going into this thing, and I started realizing I fell into this trap again of blaming others for my problems. And God spoke to me right in the middle of that conversation, and I decided to stop living the lie after all these years, and I stopped and made another real amends to him. And I think I've finally forgiven him. Now, I'll have to call you guys back in a couple of months to tell you if that's the case. I don't know. But it changed away from business, and I had God tell me, you did not deserve or earn this company. Shut up. And I went, you're right. You know, I didn't put the 45 years in, 60 hours a week to build it. He did, and I just expected it to be handed to me. It's essentially what happened. Now, the situation we're in at work, some other guys came in, took over, and told me to run it. So it worked out well. I don't have the stress of the business failing. I just get to run it. So it worked out well. The whole idea was I spent so many years locked in prison for a guy, having anger for a guy, towards this guy who didn't do anything wrong, you know? And that's what this amends process opens up sometimes, this idea that we go, when we get through with a good sponsor, we look at this list and we start to realize, like, she did all this stuff. And like Dylan was saying yesterday, we set these things in motion. You know, this, wonder if this is experience ever happened to y'all. I'm at a party and I got a girlfriend, whatever, but I cheat on her with another girl. And my buddy, who's jealous, tells my old girlfriend I cheated. Now, who am I mad at? I'm mad at everybody but me. Now, I cheated. He wasn't being a dude, and he told on me, and I'm pissed off at everybody. But I'm the one that started in the beginning, and that's my whole life. I do something, I get found out full of guilt and shame. It's everybody else's fault. And that's kind of how this amends process works. And will our relationship get – one of the things you ask, and the way Dylan and I have been taught is – we say what it is that we think we've done, and we ask the other person, is there anything that I missed out? Tell me how it made you feel. Fill me in. Because we may think that we harmed somebody in a way that we didn't, but we harmed them in a way that we're not even aware of, and they let us in on a secret. And so it's again, it's a hat in hand situation. It's all about, we just walked out of 4 and 5, so we have very little ego left, and then 8, if you have any more left, 8 and 9 destroys it, okay? Because all of a sudden, humility, the lower I get, the closer I get to God. So this idea of you have to take, there has to be a massive amount of humility to do 8 and 9 properly. And you will look at that list and go, fuck that guy, I ain't ready, and that's totally fine. We ask God to help us be willing to make that amends later on down the road. Also, new guys want to make financial, every one of y'all owe money, probably more than you can ever fucking think about, right?
Me too.
Now, when I first get sober, I got $15 in my pocket, and I got a bunch of financial amends. Sponsor will tell you the same thing, hopefully. I would not suggest that you go tell people how much money you owe them when you have $15 in your pocket. But also, I've had sponsors before that will show up at a meeting. Recently, this happened with a brand new motorcycle. Now, he owes $65,000 to people in the past. He ain't paid a damn penny, but he's got a brand new motorcycle. That shows a level of the humility's not there and the willingness is not there. And of course, what happened? Now the guy's riding around his new motorcycle, okay? So that's one of those things, too. I leave something off on step 4, or I'll balk in step 9, and I'm dishonest about it, I'll drink again. I have one more experience I'll share on the 9th step, and then I'll pass it on. When we went through this process before, it was a little bit different. I went through the process with Dylan and 4 other guys that were a little bit newer, sober than me because of the fact that I had the time before. So my first 11 years, I did 95% of my amends. So I really wasn't even paying attention much, honestly, when Tarek was talking about this, and he's in depth. And I was, and the other guys were like, Dylan's like, I got 175 amends to make, and there's other guys like, I got 70. I mean, they were, and I had been through a lot of that stuff. I had totally forgotten one of the dirtiest things I'd ever done during that process. It slipped my mind, and that was I used to be the treasurer for an NA group in Birmingham, Narcotics Anonymous group, and right before I relapsed. We had a situation where the money was not being kept properly, and it was actually in my personal account because the other guy on the account had relapsed, and they were afraid he was going to steal it or whatever. And I left that meeting with their money. Now, in my rational or irrational alcoholic selfish mind, I believed that when I had resigned that position that I had brought the money to that church for them in cash. I did, but I was $300 short when I did it. Now, all of a sudden it hit me. I was actually in church the day after we went over the steps. And I was like, I wish I had I actually had this idea of like, this is how ego the addict works. I wish I had a big amends to make so I could feel the experience that those guys are feeling right now. And God said, what about that money you stole from that group? And all of a sudden it hit me. And I said, I need to do that. When he said, yeah, you need to do it today. So what was interesting is that group was really held together by this married couple. And they were there every time they started the group, whatever. And the funds that were taken by me had to be replaced by them for rent, coffee, so they took it on themselves. I did not think, first of all, I didn't think it was 300. I thought I owed about 70. And when I called, I said, hey, Jeff, it's TJ. I said, you know what I'm calling about? And he said, yeah, I know what you're talking about. And I said, I think maybe I took some money. He said, you took $272.36. You left on October 22nd of 2017, and we hadn't seen you since. Now, what's interesting is when I first came back and went to an NA meeting, Jeff walked up to me and hugged me, and he didn't say anything about it. The most beautiful experience I've had in the program is that they could have, the day after I took that money, called me and told everybody in the community that I robbed them. They didn't say anything because they knew one day I would come back around and make it right. And I asked him, part of the eighth step is not just making a list, it's actually setting up an appointment to make this thing right. You can't just go bust somebody's door down and say, I got to make an amends right now. You have to let them know what's going on. So I asked him if it would be okay if you could talk to you and your wife. I would like to meet you this evening to make it right, and I'll bring you the money. And he said, let me call you back. And he said, she's okay with it. Meet us there at 6 before the meeting. And they sat me back in the room, and they let me do the whole spiel. I was crying, and they just sat there and listened. I was wrong. I took the money. I'm so sorry. Here it is. I make it right. And they just smiled and were so happy for me. It was the most unbelievable experience I ever had in my life. Now, I always had a judgment against people in NA because it's kind of a fellowship-based thing. And they don't really get in-depth with the steps and just kind of just hang out or whatever. But they showed me a level of spirituality today that I have still yet to reach it. And I hope that I will one day. And the idea that they could have told everybody in town that knew me that I took that money, they could have come and got me. But they just wrote it down and put the date on there and waited for me to make the opportunity to make it right. And it was a beautiful experience. And the second thing I asked them was, who else knows that would be affected that I need to talk to? They said, we didn't tell nobody. So they didn't put me on blast. And you guys know alcoholics and addicts. We love putting people on blast. Now, did they tell other people? I don't know. But in that moment, I chose to believe that they kept the secret for themselves to give me the opportunity. It was the most spiritual experience I ever had in my life. And then it comes time at the end. What do? You got to pull the $256.36 out of your pocket and you pay. And they wrote it down. And they had this thing on his list that said, this addict made a mistake and took some money on this day and has come back and made amends and set it right. And as far as this group concerned, this matter is closed. It wasn't this guy got high and stole our money and wouldn't use it on pills. It was just an oversight, and he came back to make it right. Matter closed, all's forgiven, welcome. So that's the kind of stuff that'll happen. Most situations are like that when we go back to do it. But whatever you do, if you guys have access to a phone or that, some guys are like to text their girlfriend. That's not the first thing I do when I get out of here. I got to go make it right with my old lady. There's a reason that it's done in order. Always under sponsorship supervision, or at least a phone call before doing it. Of course, I talked to Tarek before that. But then sometimes they just pop up. If you're walking through Walmart, I always do the Walmart test. This is how I think about people I owed amends to. I think to myself, if I saw that guy in a Walmart, would I throw all the stuff I've got in the nearest shelf and hit the door and run out of there? Or would I be able to go up and talk to him? If I throw my shit and run out, I owe amends to that person. That's a good way to gauge it. So those are the people that go on the list. And of course you have the ones that you lay up at night and think about. But anyway, it's a powerful experience that should be shared by all, and it's unique to everybody. Always go under a sponsorship direction there. And what it happens is the ego is being smashed, and I'm being driven deeper into a relationship with God. You know, and hopefully, and Dylan will say this too, harming other people and owing amends doesn't stop when you get sober. I've made as many or more amends being sober than I have, because I'm still full of judgment and jealousy and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Dylan knows me. We'll sit in the, we have a same home group. No, people start sharing, and we both just, I can't believe this. So-and-so speaking. It's like, when are they going to talk about recovery? What the hell are they going on and on about? There's still judgment that goes on. I still owe amends. The good thing about having a wife in the program who works at 10th Step is about twice a week, I'll pull her aside and say, I was wrong for what I did earlier. I'm sorry. Let's get past it. Will you forgive me? Whatever. I mean, it goes on all the time. And that's just evidence of these character defects that are still there, that I still make a mess. The good thing is I'm able to clean them up before too long. Some of you guys got amends to go back 18, 20 years. And some of these people are going to tell you to fuck off and not see them. You know, that's just what I was taught. Is I had one like that. I sent the text to the guy. You use Facebook, whatever you can, to find these people. And I sent him and told him what I want to do. And he said, no thanks. I'm not interested in seeing you. I waited 6 months and I tried it again. This time it was, fuck off. I'm not interested in seeing you. My sponsor told me, if you try 3 times, you're stalking the guy. You know, give him 2 chances and that's it. The interesting thing was, about a month ago, he'd been drinking and he called me. It's the first call I got. And he allowed me to make it right and met him at a meeting. So it'll come back around. God's got a plan for all of it. And the beautiful relationships come. And a lot of times the other person gets more out of it than we do, because they're a lot of times they look like you're looking at a ghost when they see you. Because they can't believe this is the same guy who's walking down the street with barefooted holding a TV, and now he's coming back making it right. You know, it's a really powerful experience. So I'm going to pass it on to Dylan and let him finish up with that.
Thank you. What's the difference between the 8th and the 9th step? 8 is where I get free. 9 is where the other person does. Now, correction, at the time we went through the steps, I had 132. And I owe Shelby County alone $7.2 million in restitution. It's a lot. You know, the book lays it out kind of differently than what we do today, and part of that's evolution, and some people call it blasphemy, but it says to go to the person you hate first, and then it talks about money, and then it talks about jail, and then it talks about family, but somehow we do it backwards, but it still works. The first amends I ever made was probably the most eye-opening. So, I told y'all about 2020 when I came around, and I was faking it till I made it and chairing a bunch of HA meetings and eating acid and smoking DMT and blah, blah, blah. And so my first sponsor, you know, I'm in a Xanax blackout, and I went through 3 places, hotel to this girl's house to kick me out, and then my little sister's house, and she walks in and I got shit scattered everywhere. And she's got, my nephew was probably 6 at the time. She goes, what are you doing? I said, I dropped a bag of heroin. I'm trying to find it before Connor does. She's like, you got to go. So now in the midst of all that, I had met this girl. There's always a girl. And she was normal. And she had let me use her car to drive my stuff from the one house to the other. And I had acquired some things that I thought belonged to me. Ever happened to any of y'all? Yeah, like, look what I found. I didn't even know I had a Nintendo Switch and a laptop, you know? And so Brock and Billy come and get me. Let me tell you something, man. The kindness of strangers. we were talking about it on the drive over here. If ever there was anybody that trusted me before they should have, it was them. And, you know, I love that dude to this day, man. And so I go to make this amends to Brock for lying to him, right? Now, in the process of them taking me to detox at the hospital, I got this Nintendo Switch. So let me paint a picture for you. So, like, the office is the Women and Children's Center, and this is the emergency room, and we're over here. I say, hey, hold on a second. I got to go give my buddy his Nintendo Switch back. What I'm doing is meeting the dope man to get half a gram of heroin, okay? All right, so I do that, you know, fucking subsequently it spills in my boxers, and that sucked. And, you know, so I'd done that fifth step. We can do six and seven. And I didn't really understand any of that shit. You know, he's like, go make it right. So I could walk to Brock's house. I had no car when I got sober. And so we're sitting on the porch. And I said, hey, man, I need to make amends to you for lying to you. And is there anything I left out? He said, yeah, there is. You jeopardized mine and my wife's freedom when I was trying to help you. What if we had got pulled over with stolen merchandise in the car and my wife's on probation and I've never had a felony? And you know, the first thing that pops into my mind is I'm a gangster. I'm not going to let you take a case for me. You know what I mean? Like that, for real, that's not how I'm wired. You know? Perspective shift. And humility. Because I don't have all the answers. And it's also, it's so deep, man. Because here's the thing, right? Is number one, it shows me how my defects affect other people. That's why when I say the miracle of 6 and 7 happens in the actions of 8 through 12, that's what I'm talking about. The flip side of it is, we go back to this brokenness and this need for God. And when I experience the grace and forgiveness of other people that I don't know that I would have forgiven me if I was Brock, it opens me up to God's infinite love. Right? Because this is the step where there's really no sponsor involved. You know, I mean, I talk to him, but he's not with me. Right? And there's a lot of fear surrounding a lot of them. So, you know, my mom was a cop. Shocker. I got 200 felonies, by the way. So, you know, the adage is true. Preacher's kid, cop's kid. And, you know, my mom was on my resentment list because she didn't love me because, like, they had got split, right? My dad took me and she took my little sisters, blah, blah, blah. But when the shit hit the fan and the court goes, because my dad worked 16, 18 hours a day, you know, and they're like, well, you can't stop getting high at dad's house. Go live with mom. So my mom would get up at 3:30 every morning, drive to Birmingham, worked in the jail, get off at 2:30, haul ass 30 minutes roughly to Alabaster, right, TJ? Pick me up off the school bus, take me to drug court or drug classes in a sheriff's uniform. Pee in a cup. The guilt and shame. And I didn't really have any awareness about it, right? About how my actions, even back then, impacted somebody else. So, and you know, there's some other stuff. I got a terrorist threat one time, and the ATF raided her house. You know, when my dad died, police came to her, because I used her address. She's the only stable one. So every time they're looking for Dylan, guess whose house they go to? My mom lives in a very nice neighborhood. There's a Christian school in there. I've made the news. I've been to the jail, you know, where everybody knows her and they would say, that poor woman. So I get sober, right? And I never told my mom that I had relapsed from 2020 to, you know, at the end of 2020. So I get sober. 2021, so 2022, right? I had this experience. I never made a formal amends. It's by the time Frank was sponsoring me, and my family's not really interested in what I say, they watch what I do, right? And this is where intuition really kind of comes in, right? Because I got to have the willingness, but I also have to know the proper moment. Now, my dad died while I was still out there. I'd stole his car, and there was a lot of guilt and shame about that. The day he died, he had a heart attack. I stole his car one night, had a heart attack same night, and died while I was on a run. You know, because I'm a tornado, touching the lives of everybody around me, especially my family. You know what I mean? Hell, I stole my mom's whole house. Carpet, fucking oven, Christmas tree, car, everything. At 15 years old. Sold it for 2 bricks of cocaine. How do you make that right? Not with words. I used to poo-poo the idea of a living amends. It's not in the book. You know, very fire and brimstone, black and white, and it's not really effective. So Christmas of 2021, I have this interesting experience. I got 9 sisters, only boy. Now, I used to have to call my mom when I crossed the Shelby County line so she could lock her door and get her pistol, because they never knew what I was capable of. Everybody's arguing about where I'm going to stay. Not because nobody wants me. Everybody wants me at their house. I've been, 10 months sober at the time? And through that process, I had started to do some things. I would call and check on her. Not for money. I would go see her. So April 2022 rolls around, and I get a call. Now I'd made amends to my baby mama and kind of got back in my kid's life, and my sister that introduced me to, you know, kind of the drugs and the alcohol and ex-girlfriends. And I'd had some powerful experiences. So in February, I got my own place. Finally got out of sober living, got the first legal document. It's not a warrant that has my name on it, right? And true story. You know, I go and my mom just kind of brushes it off. She says, hey man, you know, the past is the past and I'm just glad you're doing good now. That's in February, roughly around Valentine's Day. Right before Daytona, because you don't fuck with her during NASCAR. But anyway. April the 9th, I get a phone call. Have you heard? Ain't the best way to start one, I think we can all agree, you know? And my mom had had a stroke. And I'm at this event. This is when the HUD had changed locations. And I said, all right. You know, and she lives close to a hospital. So, you know, and she made it through that. And I go over the weekend of my birthday. And I'm getting ready to leave. And my mom stands up. She says, Dylan, whatever you're doing, keep on doing. I'm so proud of you. I've never seen you look so good. My entire life, I've been 120 to 140 pounds, besides when I was in the Army. And that's April. You know, I show up for Mother's Day. Even when I was out there, I'd get all my sister's Mother's Day cards and all that shit, you know. And because I'm not inherently bad, right? I'm just selfish. Like, I love my family, but, like, if you're in the way of what I want, then I'll run over you. So I continue through this process, and September the 3rd, this is important, and I'm telling multiple stories inside of a big story. See, I'd made amends to all my other sisters, and I have experiences, and they're all pretty positive. So now when my dad died, I was 19 years old, on the run. 375 fucking felonies hanging over my head. Life sentence, probably. Last person to know. Number one, because they couldn't find me. But also, I'm the last person to get bad news because everybody's worried about how Dylan reacts. So we had started that step work group, and I had a job as a result of this program where I worked 6 days a week, and I was the team lead. I'd got two promotions, all this grace. You know, I've got a car, license with insurance, and it's registered. Shit. You know, quadruple. That's a new thing. Got off probation. Get up, get ready to hear some bad news. And I knew. My mom was 77 years old. She'd had an aneurysm for 30 years. And I got this odd sensation. I got up, drank some coffee, did my practices, you know. Called them back. They said, Mama passed last night. Can you come down? Grabbed my laptop. I get in the car about 4:30 in the morning. It's a beautiful thing, man. The power of God through all these experiences in that amends. Losing my mama was hard. And TJ can tell you this. He's a witness. That same day, I was on a Zoom call at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm not confused about what keeps me grounded. It's my active involvement in this. And even that's not good enough, right? But the grace shows up. And my sisters are all fucked up and crying and snot. But I had this sense of peace, man. Me and my mama had no unfinished business. You know? None. Whatsoever. She got to see me live a sober and successful life. And I wish that was the case as far as my sister that's still out there. But that's the power of it, right? And that's the beautiful, shiny one through the darkness. There's this flip side of it, man. You know, I robbed a lot of people. I was probably more addicted to robbing people. And I'm not talking about burglary. I'm talking about robbery than I was getting high. There's an adrenaline rush that comes with it. And, you know, I've been experiencing the kindness of strangers for years. But I just assumed that they were weak. So there's this fellow in 2020, right before I had attempted to get sober, I'm staying in this shed that looks about like Bo's, you know, and it's fucking August and there's all this crazy shit going on. I'm detoxing off heroin, drinking liquid G, convinced there will be a civil war, you know. All I got's an AR-15 and some liquid G, because I'm ready. And I was real out there, brother. So I stayed with this dude, the dude's shed who I stayed in, and I subsequently had wrote this bad check. It's what I'm going to court for. Hadn't reported, and my brother-in-law said, "Hey, man, you know you're going back to prison." And I said, "It's all right, man. Anything's better than this." This is no way for any human being to live. So I write that check, and I'd prom. This dude had been buying me cigarettes and feeding me, and so I'd given him the money that I owed him, and I said, "Oh man, I need that back because I need to go on the run because I'm in the grips of it." And I end up leaving, you know, don't hear nothing from him. So I make this approach via messenger, and he says words. I'm going to butcher this, but basically. Yeah, I know what you're trying to do, but I don't have to listen to it. Good luck trying to stay sober. Don't contact me again. Humility. Right? Because, see, it's a beautiful thing to have the experience like I've had with my mom and my daughter and with Brock. But I really get a full dose of 6 and 7 and how my defects impact people when 2 years down the line, 20 years down the line, my actions have hurt them so much they don't even want to fucking talk to me anymore. It drives home this idea that I have to have God's help. That my reliance has to be upon God to change me because on my own power I can't do it. So, you know, I talked about, this is going to segue into the 10th step promises, but I want to touch on the 9th step promises because I sponsor a lot of guys, right, and they'd be like, they get a car, and I'm guilty of this, right? Like, I get the apartment, and it's like, the promise is coming true. It don't say nothing about gaining nothing material, brother. It's all about internal states. The fear of economic insecurity will leave us. Right. I ain't got a lot of money right now. Not really worried about it. Number one, because I've been broke my entire life. But number two, because God always makes a way. So, you know, when I got diagnosed with HIV, the dude I was staying with is this fellow who will remain unnamed because he might make it to us, he might not. But he is one of those weird situations, you know, like, well, he respects me enough to not get high around me. You know what I'm saying? And he did. And, you know, I took advantage of his kindness to go so far as to wake up at 4:30 in the morning and walk out the door like I was going to work and sit on a trail and just listen to Joe and Charlie tapes and then rub leaves all over myself and come back and make up excuses about what happened to the money for rent. And he got fed up with it. Now, mind you, I was sober during all this. So I'm at the wall one night. This is about a year and a half ago. And I had paid him the money back. It's like $600 for rent with interest. But I had never been able to make the approach, like the in-person amends, which needed to be made. And he kept bugging me about these shoes I got on right now and AA comes of age and a Bible I had left at his house. So I talked it over with my sponsor, and he's like, you know, it's God's calling you in there for a reason. So I go in there after the meeting. Now, keep in mind, I've dialogued this with a lot of people. I know I'm going into a lion's den, probably. And I walk in, and the first two things I see is a meth bubbler and a pack of rigs that are loaded up. And the miracle of it is I don't go, oh, hell yeah. I experience empathy or sympathy or pity. This poor bastard doesn't know there's another way. So I sit down and I make the amends, and, you know, I say, if you ever need anything, man, I'm here. If you ever get tired of living the way you're living. And I left it at that. And I hope he finds his way to us. He's one of those people that's hung up on the God thing. But then, you know, it doesn't really hit me in the moment. And I've had other experiences, like been at concerts and people are snorting dope off CD cases or whatever. And I don't realize it in the moment. You hear about this position of neutrality, being safe and protected. I'm not even sworn off. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. And I walk out of there and I call Chris. I'm like, man, God is good. You know? And I had that experience at a Jelly Roll concert. I met a girl there. She's regular. I hold her Long Island iced tea while she goes to pee. She comes back, it's there. You know? How? For a guy that can't stop, won't stop. Submitting to the process. There's a guy named Dr. Harry Tebow that talks about compliance versus surrender and the resurgence of the alcoholic or the addict ego. And they look a lot alike. But when nobody's looking, you can tell the difference between compliance and surrender. So, and I'll wrap up with this story and we'll eat whatever we're going to eat. All those amends came as a byproduct of using drugs, right? Now, selfishness and self-centeredness was at the root of it. But then, me and TJ go through that step work group. And my current girlfriend, but, you know, it was on again, off again for a little bit. She showed up, and I've had to make amends to her twice, and neither time had I been high or drunk. And God damn, that sucks. When we got back together this time, I said, I don't know, baby. I don't want to have to make amends to you again, you know? Like, because this idea that somehow if I remove the drugs and alcohol, I become unselfish. You know, and I have to sit there, and she let me have it. And all of it was true. And it brings back home this idea that I have to rely on God if there's going to be any sort of change. And I have to surrender to this process. Because if I'm just compliant, I make the convenient amends, right? That's why I drive a $400 car. because I owe motherfuckers money. You know what I mean? A lot of it. But when I submit myself to this process, a magical thing happens. The more amends I make, the more I'm aware of God's presence everywhere I go. And you and the motherfuckers who share at our meeting that I don't really like what they have to say. Because I got ideas that everybody should say the same thing I do. You know? And I begin to have this experience. And the more I clear away the wreckage of the past and the present, because I can still be a wrecking ball. Ask Katie. Ask my sister. You know, my sister's in the program that lives with me. Her and the scissor sister. She's a lesbian. Anyway, they're both in the program. And at least twice a week, I have to, you know, we got a handshake, bro. It's dope. She knows. Anyway. I have to go, hey, man, I shouldn't have said that. I was out of line. Do you want it? And, you know, we have to have those conversations because never will I ever get to a point where I've somehow beaten the internal condition, regardless. And it all drives back to the first step experience, and it shows me how my defects, even to this day, 2 years and 8 months, impact other people. And the necessity for God. That's all we got, man, is identification and power, really, and some steps to get there and access it. I think we'll take a break till about, what, 1:15, Roscoe? All right, thank y'all, guys.